You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And our guest on this episode is Azad Volkhausen. Azad, it's great to have you here this morning.
Good to be here. Thank you very much.
So Azad, the way the show begins is with a huge question. Who are you? What do we need to know about the labels you wear, the things you've done, or the values you aspire to live by to start the conversation?
Great question. I think I always start my own self-concept with nature. I'm a lover of nature, love being outside in the woods, doing anything outdoors. I'm also a lover of dance, from the Dances of Universal Peace mm-hmm. to the Ecstatic Dance and Five Rhythms and Dance Church to Contact Improv. Those are things that are very alive for me right now. Mm-hmm. I'm also rooted in the Quakers, but haven't been active with that, but it's formed who I am.
Right,
so
right.
Fairly important part of my existence.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Kind of the your quiet part.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
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 Yeah. Yeah.
And what has helped you to, how, you know, how did you connect? Where does dance live in your life?
Let's see. I lead the Dances of Universal Peace, which leads to the another piece that I didn't mention of myself, is the Sufi path mm-hmm. Is an important part of my life,
sure.
Which includes music and dance, as well as meditation and living well, mm-hmm. living in beauty, heart.
Neat. Yeah. So what music should we open the show with?
How about doing the Sufi poem. Would you want to do that?
Okay, here we go. And this is Water Wheel?
Yeah, this is from a friend, Peron Perez.
Okay. And Faces of Love.
In my dream last night, I was a water wheel, and you were the river of light. Steadily turning me, turning me. What could this mean? Is this the way your love pours through me? And turns the big stone that mills my life into goodness. Then in my dream I walked out on the hills and saw, with a clarity only my heart possesses, see how the trees grab down into the moist earth, stretch their arms out to the sky. Don't they seem to be in love? Cows grazing on their sacramental table, and the bees so devoted to their flowers, and the birds firing up the dawn with their rejoicing. They we're all in love. Is not the sun blazing, the ocean rolling, the mountain echoing with love? Everywhere we touch the body of love. Sweet one, enter this dream with me, where you and I and all who have been touched by this light are now entrusted with this sacred task, to show the world how in this loving, all the truth we'll ever need abides. To propagate the bliss of simply saying yes to us.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca. This is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this episode is Azad Vilkazin. So Azad, tell us about that poem.
Well, it is somewhat the essence of Sufism for me, this sense of living from the heart and living in the flow, like being turned by the water wheel or the water wheel being turned by the ocean, the river of love, I guess.
Right, and so, you are the water wheel.
We are the water wheel, and we're also,
water, the water. And we are the stone that's grinding in the mill.
That's right, yeah. So getting a sense of in life, rather than having to do work, kind of be work, be the work of what's happening, letting work happen through us.
Right. And when you have to do something as though it were outside of you, you are alienated from it. That is the definition of alienation.
Right.
And when you have reintegrated into yourself, you become graceful.
Yes.
You become filled with the grace of being and doing it at the same time. Right. And being and doing are not in competition with each other.
Grace is flowing.
Yes. Beautiful. Azad, it's neat. And did you take the name Azad as part of your discipline, or?
Yeah, that did come from a Sufi teacher, Pir Vilayat Inayat Khan. Back when I was 20 years old or 19, something like that. You know, I dove in.
Sure.
And I remember him giving me this name under a tree. And it means free.
Really? That's great. I've wondered, and I didn't mean to put you on the spot asking, but I am curious. So it means free. Beautiful.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So for the next line of questioning, I like to go to, given the life that you value now, and what experiences did you have to know what that life involved and what you would have to do to live it?
I would say,
so what were your experiences?
Yeah. Well, I would say one thing that I feel like led me to this was working too hard. Also, kind of diving in, and in the Sufi path, they do talk about mastery through accomplishment.
Sure.
That everything you work through, you learn the process of working through
it,
basically. Yeah. And yet, as you get better at it, it becomes the process of manifestation, of letting things happen through you rather than making things
rather
happen.
Rather than pushing or forcing or in some sense trying too hard, as you say.
Yeah. So I think I've been such a doer sometimes, and Now there's a little change in that.
So yeah. What propelled you to be a person who would try too hard? What launched you in that direction? So, and then how did you discover the steps?
I might go back to my family roots of social activism.
Sure.
And especially being a minority, like we were the only pacifists in a militaristic community down in Virginia.
Uh-huh.
And so the change needed there felt overwhelming, felt like, we know that peace is better than war, but right. we can't change this, but we have to work as hard as we can towards it.
And we have to live it and
yeah.
push.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. yeah. And it becomes a great,
cross, I
guess. Yes, a cross yeah. to bear or a battle to wage.
Right.
Constantly,
right.
even though you're yeah. not, you're a pacifist. It's a kind of,
right.
one of the paradoxes or hypocrisies of, yeah. of having a cause.
Yeah. 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 Yeah, and I think I went through forced precociousness with my father as well, thinking back to that.
Sure.
he was a math professor, and he had me doing calculus by the time I was in junior high school. I was starting to think about calculus and taking advanced math in high school. Mm-hmm. It's like there was... I did 3 years of math at home because they didn't have a class for me. He taught me for a year, and I learned 3 years worth of math in junior high school. They wouldn't give me credit for it, but they put me on to the next class afterwards. And I felt like I learned a lot from him, but I'd come home crying sometimes from like, oh, you're making me, like what you're asking is beyond my ability. Right. Like my mind would swim with what he was requesting. And yet, I guess it's good once in a while to be asked of more than you can actually do. So
there is a standard prayer that says, "Don't ask for tasks equal to your power, but ask for power equal to your tasks."
Yeah,
and then your life yeah. will become the miracle.
Yeah, yeah, beautiful.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. 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 It's it also is coming from your father, with whom you have a much more complicated
right.
and complex relationship.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, yeah. which. Yeah, good to deal with those things.
Yeah, yeah. So when did you discover that the push, that the precociousness, that the push, I mean, there's a certain amount of that in me too, was not helpful or could get in your way?
Yeah. Yeah, that's been a gradual process for sure. And I still can dive into the doing mode for sure.
But when the first dawn of, maybe this is not so great.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, it comes in waves over the decades.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
I think that I started doing fasts and retreats back, and I probably took that too strongly, too. You know, I would do a fast every quarter with the solstice mm-hmm. and the equinoxes for 3 days, and then sometimes 11 days. And like, it's a really, and that took my push... my desire to push on things
mm-hmm.
pretty well, you know, it was a home for it, but it also got me into just being. It's like, mm-hmm. okay, on the retreats, the Sufi retreats and on the fasts, you have to slow down. And it became a source of inspiration that was really powerful for me.
Mm-hmm.
So I began to see that like the change, the most powerful change came from having those downtimes. Mm-hmm. as well. And I've also learned that like my walks in the woods in the morning, my ideal day is 2 hours of walking in the woods, either before sunrise or at sunrise or a little after. And,
wow.
and that happens enough for me to feel comfortable. But I feel like when I do that, the day already feels like it's complete in a way. Anything else is icing on the cake for me.
Right.
And starting to realize that how that made me most human, that made me the most full as a person to have that time. And I've watched with my partner, Gabrielle, you know, that she knows that if I'm starting to get too pushy,
mm-hmm.
just send me off to the woods for a little bit. Yeah.
Right.
Got to take a walk.
Yeah. 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 And she knows, and she has permission in your life to say, you look like you need to take a walk.
Yeah, that's right.
That's yeah. neat. That's
yeah.
neat.
Yeah.
So walk us up closer to now. What else? What other things besides slowing down, being present? What you described there wasn't just a quality of being, but also being grateful, which is and that's kind of beyond grace to gratitude.
Yeah. What's that saying that, you know, when your gratitude exceeds your expectations, life is good. You know, when your level of gratitude is higher than your level of expectations, then life is in. That it's, you can have both be high.
Yeah.
As long as the gratitude is kind of
right, it means you don't push too hard.
Yeah.
And you won't become. I've struggled a lot with being exasperated because I've had ideas or concerns that I've had a hard time communicating to others or fulfilling on my own.
Yeah.
And that exasperation is just a frustrated. It's not anger at anybody except oneself.
Right.
Yeah. So. Let's cut to music. What should we play next?
Let's see. How about Travis Knapp? Some little local music. Travis and Alyssa will be with us next week.
Here. Okay. Why don't you talk about that briefly? You're also one of the coordinators of a Mythica Men's.
Yes. It? Yeah. Mythica Men's Fest is happening. The weekend of June 21st to the 24th. And we have people coming from all over the Northeast for sure for it. And not a big group, but it's going to be a really wonderful gathering. And then we have a dance gathering the next weekend. The Dances of Universal Peace is the centerpiece of it, but it'll also have contact improv and ecstatic dance church style things.
And will there be things going on during the week between the two
weekends? Yeah. We have Arnott Forest for that whole 10 days, basically. So between that is open space where anything can happen.
Sure.
And there are concerts and dance each night. So on Monday, it'll be a friend, Malika from Colombia. On Tuesday, it'll be Travis and Alyssa, and on Wednesday it'll be a band called Who Dosed. So hopefully we'll get to hear a little bit of each of those.
Sure. And if people wish to participate in the men's retreat or the dances Universal Peace program or these concerts, where do they need to go to find more information?
You can go to mythica.com for the Men's Fest, and also it lists some of the things in between as
some
well.
Some of the connections, so you can, Mythica.
Yeah, Mythica is Mythaca.
mythaca.com.
Yes, we're bringing a little bit of myth into what we're doing.
Yes.
Then the Dances of Universal Peace, the dance camp, which is the 29th annual, we'll have close to 100 people there, and that's easiest to find through Facebook at the Ithaca Dances of Universal Peace.
Okay. Yeah. So, and this is Travis Knapp, who will be in concert with Alyssa Scholle?
Yes, yeah. With also some sing-along. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Here we go.
On Tuesday night.
Thank you. sing along, oh, honey, me. Being there, you could ever see from down there, oh, honey, me. Big old kneeling going on up here, there's a big old.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca. This is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest is Azad Volkhausen, and that was Travis Knapp performing Big Healing. So Azad, one of the places that I like to go is to kind of get a picture of your as you go through the day of your life. What is it that you're doing? What are the component parts?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, if I could start it with that time in the woods and end it with time walking, that's good. Gabrielle and I like to walk together, so that's always a nice piece of our life. But I also love the solo time in the world, in the woods, and little. I have a gorge behind my place where I'll go up and meditate for a bit and do a quick dip, such things. So that's. I feel like that's the most important thing.
Sure.
Beyond that, I do coaching and consulting, life coaching, spirituality coaching, and guiding for people. And then I do a variety of consulting work. Team building and leadership is kind of my training and background that I worked with for a long time at Cornell. And then I also do computer consulting, do some database development and information management work for people, especially at Cornell also.
And how did you... These are the lives we cobble together.
Uh-huh.
And how did you come into a sense where this is... And you're also the director of the Sufi Center.
Yes, that's right.
And how did you come to appropriate this balance, or how do you juggle these commitments, if juggling is the right word? I mean, that implies more intention and more control, maybe.
Yeah. I haven't always been good at that, for sure. But I feel like being able to prioritize some of the self-care stuff has been like what feeds me, making sure that I'm dancing each week, making sure that I'm meditating, that I'm walking, being out in nature. Right. Those things kind of give me the foundation for whatever else I'm doing. And I like to be physical, so I actually end up doing some construction work and things like that as well. And I like being with people. So scheduling the calls with folks, with people I'm coaching or working with. My favorite coaching is doing it while walking in nature.
Wow.
And so I'll do that in person, but also do that over the phone, and hopefully have each of us in touch with nature while we're doing it. Nature becomes the mirror, becomes the real guide. I'm just there as a facilitator.
Right. Yeah. But also there's a discipline in attentiveness where when you strike the visual cues, and all you have to, if you're doing this without FaceTime or whatever that is.
Right.
When you strike the visual cues and all you have are the things your ears hear, you just hear so much more.
And
you notice things, and you can actually maybe see a person more clearly with your ears than with your eyes.
Yeah.
And the other way, you can, when you strip sound and you're just observing, it's fascinating.
Yeah, it is. And it's actually kind of amazing how nature does provide the imagery, the mirroring that's needed in a moment. At one end or the other of the call, sometimes there'll be something, if you're present, instead of feeling like, okay, we have to leave what's here, being present with what's right in front of us, it can be magical.
Yeah.
From the animals that come through to the plants and water as metaphorical guides.
What brought you to this area? Are you from this area?
Yeah.
Well, you said you're from Virginia, but yes.
Yes. I have always liked having my hands in the earth, growing things. And I came to Cornell to study plant science. I had been managing a community farm in eastern New York State, actually for a Sufi community. At the time, it was about 100 people, 125 at its biggest. And I was growing food for them. And I thought, well, I'd like to get more background in this, you know, be able to be more creative in my growing, learn about permaculture and intercropping and things. And so I came to Cornell. studied there, and then started a CSA here quite a while ago, did that for a while, and basically became land-based and settled in. I've left a couple times, but never for long.
Right. And when you talked about wanting to work physical labor, you know, I also share that. In some sense, I think if I could work physical labor a day or two a week, you know, that 10 to 20 hours a week, that would be ideal. It's very hard to find a mix or a balance of things other than, you know, because our culture doesn't support that kind of integrated physical, emotional, intellectual life that you get when you do the coaching and the physical work. And
My ideal from back then, a time I look back on nostalgically, is when I was managing the farm at the abode, and it was spiritual farming. We'd do meditations, and we'd stop and tune in to the devas and the plant life there. That would be half the ideal rhythm was when Pir Vilayat was leading retreats up on the mountain above us. There's 450 acres there. So I had, you know, maybe 10 acres I was farming, 10 to 13. Mm-hmm. And we'd be down there for half the day. And then I'd go up to the mountain and support the retreats, be there for people who needed support, be a retreat guide, basically, for people the second half of the day. What a beautiful blend for me that was.
Right, you know? Right. Yeah. And what a way to grow into your role as a coach.
Yeah, that's right.
Because when you're young, you may have a lot of intuitions, but you don't have a lot of experience.
Yeah, that's right.
So... Yeah. How has life surprised you and turned out differently than what you expected? If you expected.
Yeah. Well, I guess if I'd looked at my path from back when I was a kid, I would have thought, I'm going to be very focused in social activism and in, you know, I was at protests from age 8. We were...
What years were these?
That was the Vietnam Wars. So yeah, my whole family was there protesting, and we were on the front page of some papers about integration. You know, my father was blacklisted as a communist. Mm-hmm. So I was kind of in the middle of all of that growing up.
By their choices more than yours at that point.
Yeah, but I loved it. Pretty neat to be in Washington, D.C. in the middle of these crowds at 8 years old, too. Yep. Yeah, in fact, I got lost in the crowds once or twice there. but that felt very alive. But I think there was this transition towards doing inner work, and the sense that I'm helping to create... sustainability is on all different levels, and social and activism is on all different levels.
Sure.
But helping people to find their own sense of peace inside as being a ground for whatever work we do outside. Like that shift happened sometime without me really saying, oh, I'm going to make this shift. That was a surprise, I would say. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it was a surprise that it seems like a gentle surprise.
Yeah, that's right. And
you
a gradual.
Just kind of lived into it.
Yeah.
And is that how change has happened for you mostly? You discover that it's already happening more than choosing it?
I think that's right. And I think I'm an opportunist, you know. It's not, I don't know that I've ever chosen a career, and I don't even know that I've even had a career.
Right.
But I've been in many different lines of work, and it's more what chooses me than me choosing it sometimes, it seems like. I mean, I know what I want pretty clearly. So it's not that I... But the opportunities around the things that are most precious to me, like I'll jump on them rather than say, okay, I'm in this line.
Right. A lot of people have a hard time with the term opportunism or being opportunistic.
Yeah. Yeah.
And yet at the heart of spiritual maturity is the ability to see and take the real opportunity that's at hand.
Yeah.
Rather than anticipate something that's not present or maybe never will be.
Right, right.
And that's to live a fantasy.
Yeah.
So to live in the most sustainable way is to be opportunistic.
Right.
And that takes the least advantage of anything because everything is there. Nothing needs to be forced or coerced or pushed.
Yeah.
But we've lost that notion.
From a Sufi perspective, I've been hearing this from different Sufi teachers. there's the sense that every breath is goes all the way from source to manifestation.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And the a basic Sufi practice is annihilation in the real, that kind of the sense of they call it fana and baka, the breakdown that leads to breakthrough. Mm-hmm. And basically every breath can be that, or every day can be that. It's like, if the more thoroughly you let go of your concepts, the more open you can be to what's emerging in the moment.
Right. Yes. And that is if concepts are things that you impose, but if they are ways you image or imagine,
right,
then they're not so harsh.
Right. Right.
Yes, I know what you mean.
Yeah. So my Hazrat Inayat Khan, who brought Sufism to the West back in the 1920s, mm-hmm, he started this line of Sufism called Zarat, which is the bridge between heaven and earth, but it's focused on farming as a spiritual path, basically. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And he would say that you have to plow the field completely, turn it over completely before you sow new seeds.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you take out both the good and the bad when you plow the field. And I fought that, in that I'm also a deep ecologist. I believe in, like, just letting the richness of things emerge. But mm-hmm, I also have been feeling the power of that. When you let go of everything, there's room for newness.
And we get confused sometimes with metaphors, mm-hmm, and with reality. I grew up on a farm where a deep plowing in Northwest Missouri led to some of the highest erosion rates
right,
in the U.S. And
yeah,
so they went largely to no-till
or
to contour plowing, which greatly
right,
reduced the erosion.
Right.
And my father was involved in that.
Uh-huh.
But he was also involved in every year, rather than using so many pesticides, burning off the entire stubble of the
uh-huh,
field,
yeah,
so that the next year it would be a fairly clean
right,
slate to,
from right,
which
right,
to start. And
yeah,
that's a less damaging way, I think,
yeah, yeah,
to hold the land.
Yeah. Well, it's fun to see, just behind what we're saying,
sure,
is the metaphors of life. Like,
yeah,
okay, farming becomes the metaphor,
yeah,
a way of thinking about things, and deep ecology becomes a metaphor,
mm-hmm,
and dance becomes a metaphor, and a
reality.
Yeah.
But it's,
yeah,
it's these are tools for
Understanding more deeply.
Understanding, but understanding not as kind of a fixed knowledge, but as an engagement.
Right, right. All we're ever playing with is a map or our vision of reality. Reality is always deeper than what we're seeing.
Right, so, and yet we need maps that we can each look at
right,
to know, to some extent, to understand, but also we don't need them, but sometimes they're useful.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm thinking of the Christian statement, my yoke is easy and my burden is light.
Uh-huh.
That's exactly the same spirit,
yeah,
in which this is. It's
yeah,
when you are doing this gracefully, it doesn't feel like work.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we all know that feeling. Yeah.
Yep, yep.
Yeah, yeah.
So let's take another dip into music. What should
okay,
we play?
Oh, well, Estağfurullah, is that one you have?
Yes, I have.
Yeah.
I have that.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, that one is about this plowing of the field, basically, in a
okay,
way. It's like, okay, just let's clear it all out and make room for whatever's coming through.
Okay.
Who dosed?
It's called fallow or emptiness.
Ah.
Yes, that's another way of expressing it.
Yeah, yeah.
Thank you.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca. This is the Made of Clay Report. And our guest on this episode is Azad Volkhausen. So tell me about that piece of music.
Well, as you may have guessed, that was not a professional recording. That was part of one of their live performances that made it to YouTube. And I think part of that, Who Dost is coming next Wednesday to Ithaca. It's going to be kind of opening our Dance of Universal Peace 29th annual dance gathering, which starts the next day.
Sure.
But they're very good at kind of audience engagement, getting people involved. So it's an experience. You're in an experience, not in a performance so much. And it's rooted in Sufism, but also rooted in Judaism and the spiritual traditions of the world.
Right. And this is for people who already, I mean, this is the challenge of living the experience rather than being an observer in the performance.
Yeah.
And we it's very hard to maintain living in the experience.
Yeah.
We often distance ourselves.
Yeah.
And in this political environment, it's really easy to not live in the experience, but to distance yourself.
Alienate.
Yeah, and to alienate the other and to alienate your tribe from others or your values from others.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I'll dive in.
Yeah.
I think for both of these gatherings, the Men's Fest and the Dance of Universal Peace, the dance gathering, it's a lot about building connection, building a sense of community, which has been an integral part of my life since probably day one. You know, but is an important part of my sense of purpose as well as building community.
Right. You use two words that are potentially at odds with each other. Connection, which is the heart of community, and building, which can be, but it's oftentimes organizing. If it's organized, it's not a community. And if it's a community, it's not organized, but it's that openness to connection.
Right.
And that allows us to engage, learn, whatever, with almost complete and total self-determination.
Yeah.
By choice. No, there's no coercion. But in an organization or a social movement or there is coercion. That's how allegiance and loyalty is kind of enforced. But in community, it is completely voluntary.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember when I was just before I ran into Sufism, when I was looking for a spiritual path and saying, well, you know, I know I need some guidance. I want something to help me move forward in the spiritual path, but I can't see myself joining an organization, you know, or a structure so much. And Sufism came along and it felt like it did that well, that it was both.
There's a structure behind it.
Yeah. And there's freedom.
Right.
You know, I was always told, you know, you're not letting go of whatever your religious and cultural roots are. You're getting a deeper understanding of them through this.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we need organizations and structures and institutions to provide the scaffolding upon which we build lives and buildings and create enduring commitments that we can kind of, in a certain sense, bank on.
Yeah.
But we also need the completely other, just ephemeral connections that come and go, that with an openness that is no respecter of status and no respecter of role.
Yeah, looking at how we build community across the divides. Like one of the things about Dance of Universal Peace is this, like it's happening all over the world in places that are torn up, in places that in developing countries and in developed countries, however you want to say that. But it's about finding the common ground behind the deepest aspects of each culture. And finding the longing,
a place to connect there.
Yeah, yeah.
But not and to connect, which is not necessarily to do.
Right, yeah, right.
To organize for anything.
The dances of Universal Peace. You've experienced them. Like it's one of the few places where you have permission to just stand there silently or while chanting something and stare into somebody else's eyes. We don't have permission for that very much anywhere else.
Right.
You know, that like there's just that freedom, and you can have whatever feelings are emerging be part of that experience. Like there may be a sense of sensuality or mirroring that happens. There are all sorts of things that can emerge in that, but it's just space for it. It's not like you're going anywhere with any of this. You're deepening a sense of connection, recognizing that we are the eyes through which God sees. We are the eyes of the world, as the Grateful Dead says, that we are, there's common ground with any person when you look in their eyes.
Right. And it's, I want to spend a little time with this. It's not about being polite. Mm-hmm. You know, I grew up in a rural Midwestern culture where the old men and old women would behold you, which meant they would look at you. They would take mm-hmm. you in.
Yeah.
You stood in front of them when the old yeah. men sat on the benches on Main Street in King City after the years of work were no longer available to them. They had worked themselves out, but were still, they would put their hands together with fingertips touching fingertips, and they would sit with their legs crossed or with their feet flat on the ground, uh-huh. and they would behold you.
Beautiful.
And you were seen, and you would see them.
Yeah.
And also many, I remember many pictures that were taken of rural people, especially during the Depression, when they would look out at you with big eyes. The eyes were yeah. too big. And some people would say, well, that's poverty and mental illness. And I would say, that's wonder.
yeah.
You know? And, yeah. And so we almost don't know how to engage in this big-eyed behold.
It can be very hard for people yeah. coming to the Dances of Universal Peace at first because yeah. of that, where I'm just going to stand here and stare in your eyes.
Yeah.
I can't do that. I have to look away, yeah. you know, but which is fine. It's like, that's okay. But it's getting comfortable with something, sort of a lost skill, a right. lost doorway.
Right. And because we, as we, and I use we loosely here, Americans with the commodification and marketization of everything, we gave up those disciplines without even realizing that we had them. Because yeah. those old men would never have described what they were doing as a spiritual discipline.
That's right.
That's language yeah. that would have, that's just what people did.
That was very integrated. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. yeah. And when it's so integrated, we almost lose it.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
it, we don't, you know, we, yeah, we don't yeah, know we how don't, to value it.
Right.
Yeah. 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 So tell me, what inspired you to become involved with this, with the calling together of this men's retreat?
Yeah. That's been quite a path for me. I was working, one of the people who's coming to the retreat, the festival, mm-hmm. Or the fest, is Robert Heasley, who used to live in Ithaca, and we created men's retreats together out of our own need, our mm-hmm. own desire sure. for connection with men. We created a retreat that we called Finding Our Fire, which was looking at where's our passion, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. how do we make room for that? Where's the spark? What ignites us? And building on that, letting that be a foundation for our lives. And they were wonderful retreats. And out of that, another friend, Tony Simons, created a men's group that like said, okay, I want to keep this going.
Mm-hmm,
started
sure.
a men's group, which is going now, and I've been in and out of that. And he'll be presenting at the fest also. With you, Eric.
Yes,
that's right.
And
yes,
I, and, yeah. and in full disclosure, I will be on a panel on Saturday afternoon from 3:45 to 5:45 mm-hmm. about how do you organize men's groups,
right?
And
right.
and what do you consider, and what are some of the different ways? Because we each have extremely different ways of
right.
of organizing
yeah.
these things.
Yeah, Robert and I came at it from very different perspectives. Sure. I was kind of the meditative, mm-hmm. From the Sufi perspective,
sure.
and he was coming at it from reevaluation counseling, peer counseling,
right.
RC, and we combined those. And I came at it from wilderness and nature. Like I just wanted to get people out in the woods and let nature do the connecting for
right.
us. So there were those different pieces that were coming into it, and yeah, I mean I feel like I've sometimes gone almost too far with this, where it was like, oh, this is more important to me than my work. Oops.
yes. No.
Yep. But I feel like that fed all sorts of events for men that grew back decades ago, actually. You
right.
know, we used to have a men's fest here, and it was very powerful at the time and has faded. And I started saying, well, somebody should make this come back. And
right.
of course,
right.
the somebody was me.
right. Well, when you say that, that's kind of what happens.
Yeah.
So what was it in the past, and how many people were involved? Where did they pull from, you know?
In the past
yeah.
for the men's fest?
Yeah.
Well, so we have had groups of anywhere from 3 to 10 people that I've been part of been powerful.
Yeah, no, but I mean yeah. the
men's fest.
The men's fest, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. yeah. Ithaca Men's Fest. It was fairly famous throughout the Northeast. People would come from all over. We had definitely folks from New York City, from up in Maine, from Connecticut, Pennsylvania, Ohio, wow. quite a variety. Yeah, and some further south.
Sure.
But we were kind of the hub for the, we were a hub for the Northeast and,
right.
and a strong center for men for who wanted connection. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting how it's blended between, well, the different gender orientations and gay, straight, that it feels like it's sometimes gone back and forth on where the stronger focus was. But I think it's also really been a meeting between different worlds that way.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So there's room for all orientations.
Sure.
And we do want people to be identifying as male when they come. But there's a sense that there's that's it's inclusive. The rainbow is welcome.
If you're non-binary, this is a place to explore right. one part of the non-binary.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. Experience. We've definitely had people and who are have gender flow for sure.
Sure. Yeah. yeah. And I how did you get introduced in a conscious way to men's issues?
Well, I'll give some credit to Robert Heasley there, also known as Spirit. Robert was a teacher of men's issues, of gender mm-hmm. and sexuality at Ithaca College at the time. And now I think he's been at Swarthmore down that way. Mm-hmm. He's been teaching down there. And I think I learned experientially. There were some other people locally who were ready to explore with me and kind of dive in. So Neil Wecker, I don't know if you know him, mm-hmm. but has been active with men's sexuality as well at times. And I ran into Paul Nelson, who's also going to be offering a workshop, I don't know if this is fair to say, but he's probably the world expert on penises.
yes.
But he's worked with issues of erectile dysfunction, things mm-hmm. like that. But also is just he's helping people to redefine sexuality, mm-hmm. male sexuality, and to look at what the myths are, another side of Mythica. You know,
right.
what are the myths about what male sexuality is or needs to be or could be versus what's real for us.
Right. And when are myths damaging and when are they life-giving?
Yeah.
And for me, I came into awareness through a book, The Hazards of Being Male,
uh-huh.
which was expected to be like, was hoped to be, it would be a book to inspire a men's movement the way several books had helped inspire a feminist movement
yeah.
Just a few years early.
Back yeah,
then.
Yeah.
This was in the early, mid-1970s. And but I have walked with that awareness through more traditional environments, mm-hmm. church environments, through more traditional men's people involved in the military
yeah.
and stuff like that. So the backdrop behind me is much more conventional.
Yeah, yeah.
But I also find people in those environments are as capable of pressing the paradoxes.
Yeah.
And exploring the idea that anything that's too rigidly defined is probably not life-giving.
Right, right. Yeah. Yeah, I think part of what we run into in working in men's groups, mm-hmm. probably I won't speak for you, but
right.
with you, is this sense that we get stuck in our definition of male. We get stuck in boundary or the creation that our society has given us about what it means to be a male, and end up often letting go of this sense of connection. And the connection becomes like opening the door to a sense of connected maleness is a breakthrough for people.
Right, right. And so I tend to take it even a step further in my own mm-hmm. my own work, is that we show up at a table in fairly radical equality, and if somebody needs to step in where they don't feel like I'm facilitating well, I don't mm-hmm. push back on that. I mean, we see where it goes and then we'll explore, but we all have a place at the table
yeah.
and it's just to show up. And so we don't even it's put us in the position of foregoing topics.
Uh-huh.
People
right.
check in about
right.
where they are in their lives. If a topic emerges, we may spend that's tightly linked to that person's life. Then
right.
the collective wisdom and knowledge at the table will address it for a few minutes, and
yeah.
then we'll move on to the next person, because it's our personhood
yeah.
that matters more than anything. And then we'll figure out what it means for each one of us to be male or
yes.
whatever.
Yeah, that's yeah. right. And I think the idea of basically leaderless or leaderful men's groups right. is a beautiful thing, is that we all have things to offer. And part of what's been strong for me, bringing my strands of consciousness to mm-hmm. this, is getting experiential, like getting people out in the woods, getting people moving their bodies, getting people maybe dancing, maybe just interacting, pushing hands, a Tai Chi exercise, things like that, doing yoga together, right. things that get us out of our heads as well, but then use that to facilitate us being able to go more deeply into whatever our challenges are.
Right, right.
And each we find that we have such common ground in our challenges as well.
Right, and the trick is to find the push through something that somebody has never experienced before, so they can be released into into an experience.
Yeah,
and then not becoming like ritually redundant.
Yeah,
or reflexing and having to do the same things over and over again. Because once a person has gotten there, then they need to just go there with other people or bring them in.
Yeah,
and that's kind of the paradox of doing these things as community as opposed to organization.
Yeah,
because there's no teachings to which you're indoctrinated.
Right.
Or
right.
a thing that you have to sign on to.
It's discovery more than advocacy. Yeah.
Right, right. And at times it's challenge, but it's but and that just makes it harder to in some ways to describe.
Yeah. Yeah.
So Azad, I want to come back to your own personal spiritual disciplines. Yeah. What do you do? You've described about beginning the day and ending the day ideally with a walk alone or with your partner, Gabrielle.
Yeah.
Or you have, but what else do you do to take care of yourself intellectually and emotionally as well as physically?
I would say the components that are most important to me right now mm-hmm. are time in nature, mm-hmm. Meditation, movement, including dance and my own stretching or yoga or similar. And basically some sort of spiritual community. So for me, that includes the dance community mm-hmm. and our Sufi class, which happens every Tuesday. Mm-hmm. That like just having that regular rhythm, none of it has to be perfect. It all helps build the sense of continuity and rhythm in reconnecting, basically. Mm-hmm. So,
and when do you, you talked about how Gabrielle will remind you it's time for you to go take a walk or something along those lines. How do you know in yourself that there's something amiss that you need to attend to in your own spiritual well-being?
If I'm starting to get reactive, you know, if I'm less than pleasant to Gabrielle or anybody else, then that's a sign. Okay, time to go step outside for a minute.
Right.
Time to breathe. I can feel that rhythm in the day. I can also feel it it's time for me to back off from work and go spend mm-hmm. the night outdoors somewhere.
Right.
You know, or go on retreat for a day or whatever. So. Yeah.
And being attentive to one's rhythms doesn't make one less. I think the fear for people who live a more regimented life where they have to be defined by deadlines. Not that deadlines are bad; they can be very good.
Yeah.
But they sometimes worry: do you get anything done?
Right. Right. I feel so much more productive when I've had my walk in the morning.
Right. But also, I'm hearing that you also are more productive when you know you can walk away from something.
That's right.
Refresh yourself and come back to it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's what I had to discover too.
Right.
You know, I had to learn to let things go in order for them to thrive.
Yeah.
And for me to have a good attitude toward them. Otherwise, I would become more desperate or more insistent. And that's not a good place.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, we are winding down to the end of the show. What would you like to close with today?
Well, yeah, I forgot to mention that Yema, the band Yema, is coming to town on Friday the 21st. They were originally going to open the Mythica Fest, but it felt like it wouldn't fit in perfectly with the men's gathering, that it was mm-hmm. a little bit... So they're performing at Earth Rhythms up on Danby Road, a solstice celebration
sure.
there. And I just love her work because it blends spirit and movement so beautifully, and you can feel both the stillness and the movement. This one's a little bit more towards the still side, but they can rock too.
Okay, okay. And here we go. And Azad, it's been wonderful to get to know you.
Yeah, nice to talk with you as well. Thank you for the opportunity.
Yeah.